Well, hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Ship Talk. I'm your host, Robbie Lockman. And today I'm very excited to be talking to one of our buddies, Tracy Reagan. Tracy, thanks for coming on to the podcast today.
Oh, thank you. It's my honor. It really is.
So a little bit of background about Tracy, if you don't know her. Tracy is the CEO of a firm called Deploy Hub. So Tracy, why don't you tell the listeners, if they don't know you, a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I've been doing this thing that we call DevOps my entire professional career. When I graduated from college, it was a mainframe experience for me. And there were things like Endeavor that did all of the hard work of compiling and linking code and shipping it into production. And Endeavor, by the way, means environment for development and operations. It's the first DevOps tool ever on the market. When I started coding in C and C++ in the OS2 environment and presentation manager, I quickly learned that what we now know as continuous delivery in the distributed platform did not exist like it did on the mainframe. And it has taken me on an odyssey from understanding make files to version control to continuous integration and now continuous delivery. So I have my background is pretty deep. In 1995, I started a company called OpenMake Software, and it specializes in generating basically build control files to truly automate the compile and link steps. And that has really thrown me into this area of configuration management, which is what I'm most passionate about.
Awesome. Yeah, an excellent background. One of the things that I think you've been in industry and we've been in industry for such a long time, a lot of things that are happening in the DevOps movement seem more revolutionary than evolutionary, but you brought up a really good point. Sometimes I'm a little bit cynical about the revolution versus evolutionary argument that as a software engineer myself, I would be like, oh yeah, every time we would commit, we would have a build or have these particular steps of automation, 10, 15, 20 years ago. But I think the opportunity for more people to be exposed to it, it's what's happening out. What's been your experience? So you literally lived through a wide swath of automation. How would you categorize that?
So we'll just bring it to the present.
Yeah.
You guys did a conference and you named it Unscripted.
We did.
I have been preaching Unscripted for quite some time now. Because the area that has always held back the distributed side of the house, and now we can think about it in terms of cloud native and everywhere that has gone, has been the habit that people have of grabbing the nearest scripting tool and solving the problem with a script. And even if we call a script from a continuous delivery pipeline or a CI workflow, it's still not automated. It's still a script. A script is a script no matter how you define it, it's static, it's not declarative, and it has held us back for quite a long time. So that's how I've always seen it, even from the make perspective. I hated make files. I was writing them, but I hated them. So it was like, why don't we just generate this crap? Why do we have to write a make file? Can't this just be generated? And that's what we did with OpenMake Software and Meister. Now, ironically, when we're go up to present day, we're hearing a lot about this, SolarWinds and the huge breach at the government level.
Yep.
And CD is smack in the middle of that conversation. And unfortunately, they're talking about it as if CD could potentially have been the problem. But what the problem was the build. A file got put in a library and probably in a directory, and the build said, when you link, just take everything in this library and suck it all in and create the binary. And that allowed it to create its own life. It was the script that was the problem. It wasn't the CD process. So here we go again. I'm still preaching Unscripted. So thank you for naming that Unscripted conference. I wear my t-shirt all the time.
Awesome. Yeah, that's very excellent points there. Like, yeah, that SolarWinds hack was very complicated. I don't know if you read the Microsoft, their AppSec report, but it was like probably one of the longest AppSec reports I've read. It's like 50 pages long, like exactly how the signed DLL got in there. Like it's a common practice. Like I would say, not trying to harp on the subject too long, if a file is there, it should be trusted, but there's lots to learn after the SolarWinds hack.
It's core, though, to what we do, you know, both Deploy Hub and Harness. It's core to this conversation for us. And so it concerns me because we can't just say it was the CD pipeline that caused the problem. We have to look at, we're at a point in time when we're talking about cloud native, we're talking about microservices, we are talking about digital transformation, we're talking about going faster. We have to do all of that a lot better. We have to achieve DevOps at scale, and we're not going to do it in this old-fashioned way where you have some sort of a make script, or you have an ANT script, or whatever it is that you're trying to assemble these pieces together. And thank goodness microservices don't even require that anymore. We can finally get away from that, but it just offers new challenges that we have to solve.
Perfect. Yeah, I really like, I didn't realize your background before you started Deploy Hub was actually automating those make files. It used to drive me nuts. I started out in the Java days. I was like, why can't these ANT or maiden files be generated by the IDE? But Tracy was fighting that problem long before.
I was.
Learn Java. That's awesome. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Deploy Hub? Maybe some of the genesis. I only know you from Deploy Hub. So maybe some of the genesis, how it started. And the dog,
yeah, so,
the viewers can't see your awesome dog, but your logo is.
Well, you know, I'm a huge dog fan. I have four dogs and they're with me all the time. And I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico. So when I did the logo for Deploy Hub, I said, I need to bring in my heart to this. And sunsets and dogs work together. And so that's what that logo it represents. Ah. It's a dog and a sunset. But Deploy Hub came about because of this amazing pivot that the industry in general is making from monolithic to microservices. If we think about, you know, and again, I'm seeing all of this from the perspective of builds and configuration management. If we think about it from the perspective of CI, right, just think about continuous integration. What was continuous integration? Continuous integration is the process of checking in a file and immediately compiling it so that you always have an available release candidate. You want a 10-minute build or less, and if the build breaks, somebody needs to fix it immediately because you always want a release candidate. You always want a healthy executable that you can roll out. And the way we did that was through a compile process. And when you compile code, you do four really important steps. First of all, you create an application version. Secondly, you create a bill of material report that shows what went into it. Hopefully you were being careful about it. And that's what, you know, the OpenMake software team was worried about is the SolarWinds example is getting something stuck in there that you shouldn't have had. And thirdly, you create a difference report that says the difference between one build and the next are these files. And this is everything that auditors use. It's what production teams use to say if they're going to accept a change. And then also, if you're really good at it, you created an impact report that said, if I change this, I might impact these other teams. When you look at microservices, we throw away all of that because a microservice is like a Python script, and for example, and you might do might run a scan. You might look to see if there's Python libraries that you need to add to your container. But for the most part, it's pretty small. It's maybe 300 lines of code, not 3,000 lines of code. So we lose everything that I just talked about. We lose the application version. We lose the difference report. We lose the BOM report. And we don't have a good blast radius for the microservices that we do release. Deploy Hub was everything about tracking that. It's a microservice management platform that tracks every single microservice and its relationship outside of clusters. So it's not waiting for you to deploy it and look at a registry or API gateway to see how the transactions are being executed and monitoring. We're doing all that above the order of a cluster. I like to call it automated configuration management. And we connect into the CD pipeline at the point in time that you register a new container. That's a new release candidate, right? In the past, it was a file and it created a build. Now we say, hey, you've got a new release candidate when there's a new container registered. And that's when we go to work. The core of Deploy Hub is Ortelius. Ortelius has been added to the Continuous Delivery Foundation as an incubating project, which we're super excited about. The community is super psyched about it. And you know, our goal is to provide a way for anyone who's deploying a microservice to do so in a independently deployable manner and address this monolithic habit that we have and to help move us away from scripted environments.
Awesome. Yeah. And so for those viewers who, well, Tracy and I have a video on, but we won't hear the audio come the podcast. Tracy actually has a CD, Continuous Delivery Foundation sweater on. And so, as you mentioned, Rotilius, kind of part of the continuous, it's incubating project in the Continuous Delivery Foundation. But how I actually met Tracy was through the Continuous Delivery Foundation. I was actually one of the first foundations I ever joined that was dedicated to this pure open source. So kind of to the theme of this podcast, the importance of giving back. So I think, Tracy, you were there since the inception of the CDF, or can you tell us a little bit about what kind of drew you to it and just the importance of having the CDF out there?
So I was a founding member of the Eclipse Foundation. I was the only woman sitting on that board for quite some time. I think I was there for maybe 4 years, and I left finally. I was like, I've got to focus on my business. This is something I can't continue doing. I've served my time, and it was early on when literally Chip McGorry had 7 or 8 people in a room, and he was looking for a female to be added to it, and I was the token female, bless his heart. I'm so glad he reached out. So I left and I didn't really keep track of the Continuous Delivery Foundation. I was at a DevOps World about 2 years back, and somebody by the name of Tracy Miranda sent me an email, and she said, I'm Tracy number 2. And I'm thinking, that's weird. Her name is Tracy. I don't know why she calls herself Tracy number 2. And she said, would you like to have lunch? I'd like to talk to you about a new open source foundation. I said, absolutely. So in that meeting, I discovered that Tracy Miranda took my place on the Eclipse Foundation. So she was the new token woman. And I never knew that a Tracy replaced a Tracy, which I think is hilarious.
Even swap.
It was a total even swap. So here we, you know, fast forward, I don't know, 10 years, and she, probably longer than that, and she reaches out and says, hey, this is what we're thinking about doing. We believe that Jenkins needs to be part of a larger order. We believe this is the time for a broader discussion around continuous delivery, and we're thinking about starting the CD Foundation. Would you be able to step up and help? And of course, I said yes. How could I turn Tracy number 2 down? There's no way I would have ever said no to her. And we've become great friends, and she's been amazing to work with. And she's now the executive director of the CD Foundation, and I'm thrilled. So I've been having a lot of fun. These are my peeps, and there's nothing that thrills me more is to serve my peeps.
Awesome. Yeah. I didn't realize you were the Eclipse Foundation. The Eclipse Foundation has a special place in my heart. One of the only pieces of open source I ever contribute to. When I started my career, I worked at IBM. So actually I was working for Rational Software. So we were contributing back to something called TPTP as a funny name, TPT test platform, tooling platform. And it made it very easy. One of the few open source contributions legitimately.
I learned a lot about open source governance sitting on that board for the time that I did. I learned how difficult it is to do the lift of an open source community. And at the point in time, we didn't really know if open source was going to be as big as it is now. There was just, you know, everybody had the idea that companies like Red Hat would do really well with an open source core.
Gotcha. Yeah. Like, so you've been around the open source community for a long time, and as a software engineer yourself, for some folks who might be a little bit on the edge, like, you know, what's the point of open source, or just something free software? I'm like, it's more than that. It's about building a community. Maybe you can touch on just the importance of, hey, like, this is rationale about how we give back to the community. This is how we educate people, maybe in some sort of open source realm.
Well, first of all, I have to say that I'm a serial volunteer. I really am. I have a problem, I guess. I really like volunteering. And I've volunteered for a lot of different things, including in my local community, we have a historic ballpark that I spent a good 3 years helping to renovate, and I put a lot of heart and time into it. But to be honest, I don't like to be out of service. I like to be in service. And when you're working in a open source community, you're creating a really amazing group of people that you are going to call your friends over time. And I can't explain it. It feels like a tribe, you know. It's your tribe. It's your people that you share common interest with. You have you learn about their families. When they don't show up for meetings, you get worried about them. It really, and during COVID, I'm telling you right now, I feel like this open source community has saved me in many ways, because I'm used to being out and about. I fly to San Francisco a couple times a week or a couple times a month. I go to shows. I meet people like yourself, and I haven't been able to do that. So it's not about just the product. It's about the community. Open source is really about the community. And when you get a bunch of people together who can either rebuild a ballpark or build a really awesome microservice management tool, it's the same thing. It's about being in service with people, other people that are like you. You have similar ideas, similar thoughts, similar, you know, you both love the same problem, whether it be loving the ballpark or loving the fact that we have to figure out how to manage microservices. It's about the community. I can't emphasize that more. It has nothing to do really with the software. It really has to do with the community.
Yeah, excellent point. I seemed, when I joined the CDF, there was a lot of very like-minded people, which I was like, oh, I didn't know there were so many people who were kind of focused or had these types of ebbs and flows you're going through and sharing their story. And the good thing about the CDF, it's very inclusive. So anybody can join. We constantly have more people. If you monitor the Slack channel, there's always people joining and jumping around different special interest groups. Another, I would say, an intrinsic problem as software engineers have, Tracy certainly has an excellent brand. And so one of the challenges I've had early as a software engineer was my work never really followed me around. So, you know, what I did at IBM never went, and then I went to Red Hat, never really crossed the chasm. And stuff I worked on is like behind a firewall at some government agency because you don't want to see it or you'll be in trouble. Part of this is building a portfolio as a software engineer. So artists have portfolios. You know, we are hiring a graphic designer so we can see all their portfolios. But software engineers, on the other hand, it's hard to have a portfolio. I see like open source as a way of having a portfolio. Like, hey, look what I've created to the public. Not sure if you've seen any of that or have any thought around how can your accomplishments follow you around?
That's a good question. And I have to say that there are many software engineers who prefer not to talk to other people. You know, they don't necessarily think about themselves and their brand. And some of the most brilliant people that I've met, you look at their resume and it's incredible. And it's like, why are you not out front and center? But it takes a certain personality to be out front and center. Contributing to an open source community, though, provides those brilliant people a real platform to be recognized, because they can sit down and, you know, listen to some problem sets and get excited about contributing code where another person may just be working on, you know, outreach and blogs. Mm-hmm. That person who's working on outreach and blogs has probably started their brand, but the person who's sitting there, you know, with their headphones on and coding the hard stuff, it's harder for them to get recognized. And in most open source communities, and we're working on this now for Artilius, is there is a way, there's a recognition program, whether it be badges that you get to add onto LinkedIn about how many pull requests that you've achieved or how long you've been with a project. It certainly is a way to get some recognition for those folks who aren't interested in being out front and center.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, it really is. I like the comment you made about it being a platform for folks. And sometimes I forget because I used to be told a lot that I was too talkative to be in the software lab or be in the agile team. Like, you just talk all day. You enjoy the stand up. Just stand there and talk the whole time. Like, yeah. But other people, different strokes for different folks. It's always good to remember the spectrum, right? There's some people are more quiet or reserved, or you know, might not be as sociable, but you know, they stand by their work. So it's not every day that I get to talk to a CEO, and so I'm going to use this time for CEO related topics now. an interesting part about that, we've been fairly fortunate in the podcast to be talking to several DevOps leaders in different firms. I kind of pivot a little bit around hiring, right? So let's say that you were, it's something that's pretty critical. It's what separates, you know, it's hard to have good hiring. And I'm going through the hiring process now, expanding my team. And so what, if you're hiring like a new engineer or a new person, like what are some traits that you typically look for?
That's hard for me to put my finger on it exactly. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that some of the best people I have hired have had very little experience in the area that I'm hiring them for. I look for somebody who can display to me initiative, because OpenMake Software and Deploya, even smaller, we're small companies. And initiative is important. Somebody who is willing to come up and even during an interview say, hey, I've got this great idea, or I've looked at what you're doing on your website, and these are some suggestions I have for you. I never consider that an insult. And if anybody, when I'm looking to hire, if somebody has done that kind of research and is willing to express those ideas with me, I'm going to fall in love, because it's that kind of person that succeeds in a small company. The kind of people that don't succeed well are the ones that, might show up right at 8 o'clock and leave right at 5 o'clock, and they have their list of things that I give them to do. They're the hard ones to work with. I look for people who can display some level of initiative, and that's the best way I can describe it.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense. I think it's something that you either you have an intrinsic drive or you don't, and it's it all depends about passion, right? So going back to initiative, someone's really passionate about the job. Your thoughts are pretty much aligned with most of the DevOps leaders I talk to, that it's, you know, they hire the person, not the skill, because you can teach skill, but you can't teach the intrinsic drive. As cliche as that sounds, that's extremely true, because someone who wants to learn is definitely going to be there to learn, versus someone who's like, well, this is how you do it, and I already have my set ways.
It might be good. Here's a perfect example. We hired somebody out of Boston University who was in the film department. He had done some coding, but turns out he was really good at telling stories. And there's no better GUI designer than a storyteller. So we could teach him basic JavaScript, but we couldn't teach him how to tell a story. He had to bring that to the table. So it's if you're willing to really broaden your vision on what people can do, it's surprising the talent you can find.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really, very excellent example, right? Like some of the best software engineers that I know were like philosophy majors in university, just because they were passionate about a certain thing. They like learning a certain way, but they also have skills that can translate over, like, hey, this is what the user was thinking, or this is what, you know, like a lot of with philosophy or literature, it's like you have to get into the minds of someone's head, right? Like exactly. what were they thinking when they did that? And, instead of like, well, the computer is soulless, it just knows what you tell it. So that's a very perfect example. So Tracy, how do you go about learning new skills? Like Tracy's on the forefront of a lot of technology. If someone wants to be more like Tracy, like how do you go about learning and keeping up with industry trends?
You have to love the problem. If you love the problem, learning is easy. Now, that being said, I do have to say I schedule a lot of time on my calendar, and I try to leave my Sundays for doing reading and studying just to stay on top of this industry. And this is a wave that I've been riding for quite some time, so I've gotten in the habit of learning. I don't always drive down deep into a particular area. I oftentimes will try to understand the basic concepts and understand how they fit in. And then if I feel like I really need to understand the lower levels, like I felt like I really needed to understand Kubernetes at a much deeper level. I had to go beyond Fitbit Goes to the Zoo, but man, is that a really good place to start. And studying is, keeping frosty over the years, reading, learning new things, and you find out everything is the same. And you eventually start mapping things and go, okay, I understand. Okay, service mesh, request routing, I get that. So that's one way that I do it. But I do have to say that you have to love the problem. If you love the problem, the learning is fun.
Yeah, I never heard it explained like that before. That's awesome. It, very ornate, a very eloquent way of saying what's the intrinsic drive to keep learning. And another point I really liked that you brought up was the age-old computer science adage, everything is cyclical, and you're just like an abacus. You're just moving complexity left to right.
Exactly. exactly.
I started to notice that too. I'm like, oh, yeah, like, I've seen this problem before, but we're just having a different syntax or a different way of solving it, and the shift into complexity somewhere else. The complexity is still there, though. It's just hiding from you.
The one thing I was never good at is languages. I took like 4 years of Spanish, literally, in high school, and then 2 years in college, and I still can't speak it. I struggled with computer languages, too. I wouldn't say I was the best programmer, but the ones that I had to learn, I really dug into. But some people are so good at learning, what do they call them? Somebody can pick up a language pretty quickly. And there's some developers who use that same pattern matching that we just talked about to learn new languages. That's a skill I never could achieve.
I had the same problem. I took several years of Spanish. I can't speak a lick of it. Like,
good, I'm not the only one.
I know. It's like Trace and I are very similar. It almost cost me like graduating university on time because I had buried in the bowels of Georgia Tech. It was like you have to take a language or a programming class dedicated to languages. So I'm like, oh, I took like, you know, AP Spanish and like 4 years of Spanish in high school. Like, I can speak it. No, that was not the case. I'm like, I will take natural language processing then.
And that problem for me translated into computer languages too. I mean, I picked up COBOL pretty quickly. I think that was in college. And then I went to C and C++. Okay. But then over the time I started, like, I didn't want to learn Java. I really didn't. And man, I hate YAML. I really hate YAML.
I hate YAML. I might be understated by like how much I dislike it. I started using YAML a few years ago. 2018, I was taking the CKA exam, and I knew what I didn't know. I had to install a linter because YAML, for those who don't know, is space separated. So how many spaces you have in the next line actually matters. Supposedly that
very
makes
much,
it
very much.
It makes it more human readable. But as a human myself, I just can't see spaces. I'm not good at saying that's four spaces, that's five spaces. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So I have a linter that puts little periods where there's spaces. JSON is machine readable. I'd rather just do that. That's easy. Too funny.
Well, that's where my learning stops. I've decided languages. I think YAML was going to be the last one I ever learned.
There's this website that's like yamllinter.com. I'm pretty sure they have like thousands of like secret configurations, because I would run, like, if I couldn't figure out where like my YAML was wrong, I would run it through this website. I knew better to take the secrets out, but it's like, oh, you're missing a space here. Like, oh.
Well, you know, there used to be an editor called Brief. I literally used to keep it on a floppy, and I kept it in my purse because anywhere I went, I needed to use Brief because that's what I was used to using. And it edited columns. Now, if you, I'm sure there's an editor out there that uses columns. Somebody tell me if there is, because that would make YAML a lot easier, because then you could go through and you could swipe a column and see if they're all the same. But I don't have an editor that handles columns. And so YAML becomes really difficult. But that has nothing to do with this conversation. It's just one of my pet peeves.
I feel so like relieved someone else hates YAML. I could talk for an hour. Why do they do it like this? Tabs are better, blah, blah, blah. Data structure, come on. Yeah. So last question. I always like to add that, you know, thank you so much for your time today. Like, always like to ask this one intrinsic question, and I don't give anybody any sort of advance warning, but it's an intrinsic question. Let's say that you ran into like a young Tracy, with current Tracy, like you just graduated university and you ran into your past self on the street. What would be one or two pieces of advice that you would give yourself?
Find your voice. That's hard for women to do. I have made so many mistakes in terms of running a software company, in terms of my career, because I didn't find my voice until so late in life. I don't know how anybody can learn that. Some women pick it up. And I believe, truly believe, some of the millennials I have met have found their voice so much earlier than I ever did. And I'm really proud that women today, young women today, are finding their voice, because it is critical. It's critical for everything we do in life. So find your voice. I would have told myself that. I would have said, do it quickly.
That's very excellent advice. I think it's a struggle for a lot of people, but it's very, very prudent advice there. So Tracy, thank you so much for being on the our Ship Talk and Trip to podcast. I'm sure the listeners will love this episode. And Tracy, thanks so much for being on.
Ravi, thank you so much for inviting me. And did you ever get to go to Rio de Janeiro?
Did not. So a little backstory before we end it off. QCon, one of the dream conventions I always wanted to speak to, Tracy teed up that I could take her spot at QCon South America, or QCon Brazil. And then this pandemic happened. It was like right at the time they were like lining up the speakers, and did not. But
well, if that happens again, I'll be sure and pass it off to you.
Thank you so much, Tracy. Cheers, everybody.